Okay, welcome back, folks. Let us prepare for tonight. Tonight, our topic is going to be of Kruvim and Curtains. We are going to get into the Beis Hamikdash tonight. And really, it's good to brace ourselves because a lot of the descriptions that we're about to learn together are not things that we're very familiar with at all. We always have conceptions of the Mishkan in our mind, and this is not like the Mishkan in very many ways. So what we're going to do is we're going to move through, essentially, Perek Vav. And Perek Vav will lead us through the actual construct of the edifice of the actual temple, the Beis Hamikdash itself. Next week we're going to be off. Next week is on recess, winter break week. But the week afterwards, in 2 weeks' time, we're going to get to Perek Zayin. Perek Zayin is going to deal with the implements, the Kalim. And that's going to be a very long Perek, and there's going to be a lot of different pieces over there. But in the meantime, we're going to focus on just the building to make sure we understand the structure of this. So here we go. We're going to actually move through this in small sections. And today there actually are a bunch of pictures, and it's very helpful to have pictures for this because it's very hard to get a sense of it just with imagination. And what I'd like to do is to stop from moment to moment and try to get a sense of the meaning behind this, why it is like it is once you know what it really looks like. So we're not going to go down to drill down to a huge amount of detail, because I think it's more important right now just to have a general picture. So let's try to get the picture of the Beis Hamikdash. On the top, by the way, is an illustration of the Beis Hamikdash of Shlomo. On the top over there, one of the reasons we can know it's the Beis Hamikdash of Shlomo, not the second Beis Hamikdash illustration, is because of those two pillars that are on either side of the entranceway. We'll meet them next time when we learn about Yachin and Boaz. They actually have names, each of those pillars. And it's very different. You'll also see on the right-hand side that very large bowl, which is supported by the 12 oxen. That's going to be called the Yam Shel Shlomo. That's the wash basin. So there's a few things which are very unique to the first Beis Hamikdash, which will be our clues. Once we get through Perek Vav and Perek Zayin, we will hopefully be at least conversationally aware of some of the uniqueness of Bayis Rishon and how it differed to the Mishkan and how it differed to the second Beis Hamikdash, and how it differs to the vision of Yechezkel as well in the third Beis Hamikdash. So, I'm going to start off at the beginning. The first is a very interesting conversation that happens. Because at this point in time, has Shlomo Melech started building the Beis Hamikdash? The answer is, absolutely. We've learned about that. He's got the wood, he's quarrying the stone, he has the rotation of workers, and in fact, he's already started with his construction. So now, in the middle of this whole description, what happens is now Hashem interrupts this and has a conversation with him. And this conversation is quite perplexing, because let's look at it. We're going to focus right now on the first three psukim of today, which are going to be Perek Vav, Pasuk Yud Aleph to Yud Gimel. And here's what Hashem says to him. Adin, if you need there's extra new ones over here. I'm sorry to take you around. Here we go. Vayhi Devar Hashem El Shlomo Lemor. Hashem speaks to Shlomo and he says, Habayis Azeh Asher Atev Voneh, this house you're about to build, if you will follow my mitzvahs and all my commandments, then after every if statement you have a then statement. So folks, by the way, for this part, we're in the text itself. So this is the colored cover called Making the Mikdash. So it is in the Pesukim itself, it's on page 4. Okay, so we're holding on by Pasuk. Biyud Aleph, which is towards the middle, towards the beginning of the page. So he says, if you're going to do this, then then I will establish my covenant with you. Then I won't leave you. So Hashem interrupts the building process for a service announcement, for a broadcast to Shlomo Melech, and it's a very simple condition. You listen to me, everything's fine. Implication is, you don't listen to me, not. What is interesting to me is it's almost as if Hashem is cutting and pasting another statement which we've heard elsewhere. Does this sound familiar to you? Where does this sound familiar to you, this statement that Hashem has just made to Shlomo? This is the beginning of Parashas Bechukosah. Isn't it interesting? Listen to the language. It's almost literally word for word. The beginning of the parasha, which we call Bechukosah, which is the last parasha in Sefer Vayikra, this is what Hashem says to the nation of Israel. He says, and I put this in the actual sources, which are labeled now Unit 3.3. This is source 27. The first page here on page 12, it says, If you will walk in my statutes and you'll keep my commandments, then there's a whole bunch of thens. In that bunch of thens, a lot of them are rain, peace, all kinds of things. At the end of that, a few psukim later, the pasuk Yo'adav is, V'nosati mishkani b'mislechachem, V'nosai gal nafshi eschem. I will place my sanctuary among you, and I will not be disgusted by you. In other words, I won't abandon you. It's almost as if HaKadosh Baruch Hu is reminding Shlomo HaMelech, remember what I said then? Remember when Bnei Yisrael were in the desert? Same applies now, right? It's the same language, right? We just looked at the psukim. He says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Im teilech bechukosai, v'smishmar tai ta'aseh. It's almost the same formulation. What's the then? Then, if you're going to listen to the commands, and Pasuk Yud Gimel, he tells us, Yav shachanti b'soich b'nei Yisrael. I'm not going to leave you behind. So it's almost a direct parallel to the beginning of Parshas Bechukosai. Why do you think it's necessary for Hashem to interject in the building right now? Why is it critical for Hashem to, so to speak, lean in at this moment in the process? So interesting, because he hasn't finished, and it's after he's started. So it's not like this is the preamble, and this is not like this is the epilogue. So it's interesting to think, yeah, Dalton, what do you think?
Maybe it reminds him that he's doing it for Hashem.
I think that's 100%, Dalton, I think you're 100% on the money. And this is exactly the point, is that sometimes we get lost in the means, which means, let's think about this. What's the point of this whole business? The point of this business is to make a place for Hashem to be in this world, to give HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, a resting place among humanity. That's the goal. The means is we're going to make an elaborate, beautiful house of extreme proportions and grandeur. Fantastic. But now, once Shlomo starts doing this, and we have 30,000 men going there, and we have wood coming down the sea, and we have quarries coming in from Jerusalem, and everything's happening, it's very easy at this point in time to get lost in the means. And we're all going to get very excited, and did you see this building, and this is going to be one of the seven wonders of the world, and people are going to come from far and near, and people are going to tell there's going to be a selfie spot. Everything, you know, you can imagine this is going to be the place to be. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, let me remind you something. If I'm not in the picture, it's not worth anything. So this is a little bit of a reminder as the grandiose plans start unrolling. Just remember what's going on over here. Don't forget the ends and don't forget the means. I think that's such an important thing because we human beings are so capable of forgetting this so easily in our lives. And so this is the reminder where Hashem leans in. And by the way, does Shlomo HaMelech dissipate his enthusiasm or his grandiose plans? The answer is no. We'll see, as we're about to see, the level of sophistication and of spending on this base of Mikdash is unparalleled. This is magnificent. We'll just see in a second just why it is and to what degree it is. But with this warning in place, he still carries on, meaning to say he still wants to be a grand place for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but with the warning taken nonetheless. So that is the certificate of occupancy, I would call it, right, folks? This is the legal framework for the building. Now you can start. So he starts. Here are the plans. Let's take a look at this. We're going to do it in paragraph by paragraph because it's important to understand the different sections. But we are going to deal with a number of different rooms or chambers in the Beis Hamikdash. And so the first thing we're going to deal with is the area which is called Kodesh. Kodesh literally means holy. But it's one of the three chambers. So to make this a little easier to visualize, if you take a look at page 13, this is in the handouts for tonight, you will see just an overview map, which is to be found in Da'at Mikra, Nach, and it's very, very helpful just to get a sense to map out what we're talking about. If we take a look at the overview, that's the top map, there are three different chambers. There is, on the leftmost side, is what's called the Devir. The Devir, that can be translated as place or abode. This is the innermost chamber, which we're going to also call the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies, the inner sanctum. The middle section is called the Heichal, which is the temple, literally. That's where most of the implements belong, the menorah, the shulchan, the mizbeach. And that's the main area called the Heichal, or the Kodesh, the only, meaning only holy, not holy of holies. And then the outermost on the right is called the Ulam. The Ulam is sort of the antechamber into this. And this is all within the building. So if we flip back to the sort of the graphic illustration on the first page, the antechamber is the very tall building at the very front. And then moving inwards from there are two connected chambers, One is the Heichal, and then beyond it is the Devir inside that building. So everything we're talking about here is under roof. Outside of this is not what the topic of today. We're talking about the actual building itself. So now, let's find out a little bit about this building, what we're going to call the Kodesh at this point in time. So our text is going to take us through the following psukim right now, and that is Yud Dalet to Yud Ches. It will be our first stop. Here we have it. So Vayivin Shlomo, we're back in the text now with the translation. Vayivin Shlomo is about Habayis Vayachaleu. We finished the house. Vayivin is Kiros Habayis Mibayiso, but Tzalois Arozim. So he made the walls within were boards of cedar. Mikarka Habayis Ad Kiros Hasipun Tzipor Eitz Mibayis. So everything was from floor to ceiling was paneled. Vayitzaf is Karka Habayis B'Tzalois Beroshim. Beroshim, sorry. He covered the floor with floorboards of cypress. So the walls are made of cedar, and the floors are cypress wood. Everything is covered with wood. Vayiven es esrim amah miyarkase abayis betzalois arazim in akarka arakirois vayiven amibayis lidvir lekodesh hakodashim. And in fact, this is followed through even into the innermost chamber, which is the dvir, the kodesh hakodashim. Even the innermost chamber is also completely paneled with wood to 20 amos high. V'arba'im ba'amah hoya habayis hua heichal lifnai. And then there's the heichal area, which is that's the major, so the main middle room is 40 amos is going along is covered in this. V'erez el habayis pnima mikalois pekaim uputurei tzitzim hakol erez ein even nireh. And there were carved knobs and open flowers. So meaning into the wood were these beautiful carvings of sort of these sprouting flowers. And this was all the way through the house, so much so that no stone was to be seen. Even though what were the walls made of? The walls were made of stone, but they were paneled with wood. So much so, meaning if you look at the house on the outside, it was made with these hewn stone, which means it was very strong. But on the inside, you would see no stone, because it was completely paneled floor to ceiling, essentially. That's what we're hearing about this, yes?
You already said it was totally paneled. Now you say it's carved with knobs and flowers?
Into the panels.
Right. The implication is it's not full thickness engraving. You don't see a flower, you see a hole of a flower, or a shadow of a flower. So therefore, why are they saying again, no stone was seen?
What this means to say is that wherever you looked, we haven't finished the full description yet, but wherever you looked, you were looking at wood, not stone, even though there was stone behind it. How deep the wood was deep enough to have engravings within it. That's what it sounds like.
The first statement says, okay, and he built the walls with boards of cedar, the floor to the joists of the ceiling, covered the inside with wood.
Yep.
Okay. So now, okay, you engrave or carve in that wood, flowers, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Where does it say you're going to go through and through to see stone? There's no way to see stone.
That means to say there were no areas that were left open. So there's
that
no corners.
In the first sense. Why are we repeating it?
You know, if you want to go through the gritty, but nitty-gritty of Mefarsh on every single puzzle, we could. But right now, I want to get the big picture. Okay, that's a good deal to ask, and we'll go through the Mefarsh.
Yes, you don't.
So the answer is, we can go through the Mefarshim on this specific pasuk through the Radak, to the Ibn Ezra, to the Al-Sheikh, to the Barbanel. But I mean, what I'm trying to do is give a bigger picture over here, because we're losing time even right now. So let's keep the train moving, because we have so much to see today. But you're right, so on this particular question, I don't have an answer why it's repeated, if that's the question. So one question I do want to ask is sort of just a general question, which is why is it that the floor and the walls are made of different wood? Just basic question, right? So we have cedar and cypress. So why cedar and cypress? Why can't it all be cedar? Why can't it all be cypress? The Midrash actually tells us in Shir HaShirim a reason, very simple reason. This is to be found in our sources over here in source 29. The very top, actually on page 14, it's the second half. I'm going to skip most of the reading just to make for the sake of time. The very top line says in the middle, Dovar Acher, another explanation. Rahitenu berosim, our floors are made of cypress. Mokom shakonim ruhutim berosim, where the konim would run, which means the floor. That's why the word rahit means to run. It's the floor is called a rahit. Why? Hayach moda at Omar vayitzaf es akarka habayis betzalos berosim. Omar b'Yochanan, Rabbi Yochanan says limdo Torah dorech eretz shehei odom mekore barosim umarhit berosim. He said this is the Tanakh is teaching us basic building skills. which is that you need to have the floor out of Cyprus. Why? Midrash is missing one piece over here. The Arbabinel fills in this piece. It happens to be that what is a hardier material is Cyprus. It's a stronger wood, and wear and tear, as we all know from our dining rooms, is every few years you're going to have to redo it. You have to sand it down, and you have to reapply the polyurethane to as a layer to keep it to keep it in touch. The walls not as much. The walls require less upkeep. So therefore, interestingly enough, so Derech Eretz, that it means to say that this is the basic understanding that cedar is a little more subtle, is a little more soft than cypress. Therefore, cypress uses floor. Just fascinating insight into the use over here. Why an interesting point? So on the point that you were making a moment ago, Ira, that why is the focus on all the wood in the inside being everywhere? Like, why is that so essential? Why is that so important to us to know? Like, you know, why couldn't the stone be seen through? So interestingly, that Barbanel has incredibly long essays on this section. I took a few little gems of the Abarbanel to study together. One is to be found in source 30, in source 31. He says a very interesting point, and he says over here, I'm actually going to skip to the very end of the citation, where there's three lines on the bottom. There is a period where it says, "Voidi unu." It's three lines on the bottom of the Abarbanel. Reviis shel milvada avonim yakoros asher hayu bekoislim va'etzim hamufotochem asher hayu aleihem. There were very precious stones which were used for the walls. And he goes on before and to explain the reason why the stones were precious, they were made the walls, was because they were finely cut. Meaning, in those days, if you wanted to make a house, you take a bunch of rocks and you put them together and you'd sort of jostle them into some sort of shape, a mizbeach. If you look at the, you know, like when you say if they found an altar in archaeology, you know, it's a pile of stones. Right, their houses were, you know, a pile of stones roughly arranged with a little bit of lime in between sometimes, right? So the richness of the base of Midrash was the fact that these stones were exact. They were carved exactly. So that those stones were covered with engraved wood. As we're going to see in a moment, they covered the panels with gold as well. So the wood was covered with gold. So here essentially three layers. You had perfectly cut stones, you had the paneling of this beautiful wood with the engraving of gold into it. The calls there, why all of this, more al ma'alas, shlomo varov oshroy zehu klala sa'inyan. We're meant to get the perspective of this is luxury. We're meant to get the perspective of this is not just Tuesday's as regular. This is a very, very serious building. And in fact, the Mitzvot David goes one step further and he says, and that's why it needed to be, that in the main point was that you should see gold when you're inside. And the only way to see gold is you can't apply it to the stone, so you needed to have it actually on the wood itself, which meant that's why it was completely paneled with wood. What is not clear from here, which is just fascinating, is that obviously there were engravings. We're going to see that actually engravings were inwards, not outwards, which means it wasn't protruding, it was intruding engravings. It's not clear if the gold filled up those areas or went in with them. It was just gold leaf. Not 100% clear. It probably was a thinner layer of gold. You could go into this. But that means to say that the general tone and color is absolute gold wherever you looked. That's something we're not used to. We're used to thinking Mishkan, they had gold-covered wood as the Eatzei Shittim, acacia wood poles, and then on the top would be the curtains. Here we're talking about really essentially gold from floor to ceiling with engravings. This is extremely extravagant. Now you can just to get a sense of the picture which is happening over here. What I'd like to do is hopefully once we finish the next perek, once we go through perek Zion, there are some beautiful videos which sort of take you through this. And it's sometimes visuals destroy our own imaginative visuals, but it's actually worthwhile seeing some of the suggested, you know, sort of reconstructions to get a sense, you know, even just the color scheme is different to the way one would think naturally. Okay, so this is in terms of the inside, in terms of the paneling. Let's move on into the Kodesh HaKadoshim over here. We see a few interesting, unique things here, something which is very unusual in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. This will take us from Psukim Yud Tes to Chof Beis. So this is our next little section. We move back to the actual text itself. Ve'erez el habayis panima. This is what he says, is that there are cedars on the inner house. Miklaas pekaim piuputurei tzitzim hakol erez ein even nireh. So within it there was, I'm sorry, I'm reading the wrong passage. I was reading passage Yud Ches. Thank you. I'm just trying to make sure everybody's awake at this point in the evening. Let's try again. Yutes. There's this inner room, which is the innermost room. So as we could see just from the overview map, we see where this is. This is the Kodesh HaKodashim, the absolute innermost chamber where the Aaron belongs. He says, Hechin l'sitein sham es Aaron bris Hashem. The Ark of the Covenant was placed there. V'lifnei adivir esrim amo orech v'esrim amo oroichav. And in front of it, there was 20 by 20 area. The esrim amos komos, 20 amos high. So it was almost a box, 20 by 20 by 20 amos. V'etzapeu zohav sagur, it was covered with closed gold. V'etzav mizbeach erez, and in front of it was this cedar altar. V'etzav shlomo sabayis penimo zohav sagur, and he covered the inner sanctum with pure gold. Baraka sois zohav barak tu, sorry, baratu kois zohav. And these are chains of gold, lifnei advir vayetzapeu zohav, and they were covered with gold. Ve'es kol habayis tzipa zohav, atom kol habayis v'kol mizbeach shel advir tzipa zohav. And every implement over here in this area was covered gold as well. So this is the inner chamber. There's a whole discussion, what does it mean zohav sagur, closed gold? And one of the explanations, just I thought was a fascinating one, is that you could only buy this when all the other stores are closed. Meaning to say it was the kind of thing, this is not open market gold, this is... Even the best of the best kind of gold that you could get was reserved for the inner sanctum, the most pure, one of the most pure gold. It's interesting, when I grew up in South Africa, and the city I grew up is called Johannesburg. It was also called Egoli. Egoli means the city of gold, because when they discovered the gold mines, that's when the reason why Johannesburg was made where it is because it was made around the gold mines. And wherever you drive out of town, they have gold dumps. Now, I started realizing now that they're actually radioactive and they're getting rid of them nonetheless. they were very beautiful because they're sort of a yellowish, goldish color because that's the gold deposits. Anyway, so there's a place called Gold Reef City, used to be a mine, an active mine, and now it's actually a theme park, which seems to be the general trajectory of society. What they do is they show how they make gold, and they mine the iron ore and how they purify it. And then they actually have a bar there, and they say they have a bar, and they say, if anybody can pick this bar up with one hand, you can keep it. And of course, everybody tries, and nobody can manage because it's pure gold. It's incredibly heavy. It's a very heavy element. So there's something very special. This is absolutely purified gold, which is used in the inner sanctum. One interesting question you'll notice over here is that what is the actually dimensions of the devir, of the innermost sanctum? We have it as 20 by 20 by 20. But the problem is that the height of this building is actually 30, which means that if you take a look at the picture over here on, let's see which page it is, on the previous page, on page 13, you will see that there's a very tall antechamber. Then there's a 30-height heichal on the bottom picture. And then the inner sanctum is only 20 high. You'll notice that it has a ceiling, a sort of a room above it. Do you notice that?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is what the Meforshim deduced from this. That's what Rashi tells us actually on page 15 at the very top. He says, Ve'esrim amar komos, so it's 20 amasai, says Rashi. Kolomar aliyas shel beis kodesh ha-kodashim nemucha mishel heichal. The ceiling was lower than the rest of the sanctuary which preceded it, right? So you came into the inner sanctum, it was a box, literally. And this box was because there was this mysterious cellar above it, which took up the space. And there was an attic. What was used there is mysterious. Another question which is interesting over here is the one implement which is mentioned in this perek, besides the Aaron, is the only other thing that we're not going to see any kli mentioned except for Mizbeach HaZahav, the golden Mizbeach, which is fascinating because that belongs in the Heichal, in the middle area. We're going to see later on next week, we're going to see the menorahs and the shulchanos and all the... There's a lot of implements, a lot of fascinating implements, which there are a lot of interesting pictures of today because of Machon HaMikdash, thankfully. But the Temple Institute. But the only one that's really mentioned over here besides the Aaron is the Mizbeach. And there's something just worthwhile noting about that. And that is that when you enter into the Heichal, when you enter into what we'll call the Kodesh, which is the middle, longer and higher chamber, all the menorahs and the shulchanos, there's going to be a number of them, are on the right and the left. The only implement which is directly in the center is the Mizbeach HaZahav, and it is facing the Aaron, which is directly in the center of the Kodesh HaKadoshim. There always seems to be a connection. What's another connection between this Mizbeach HaZahav, the incense altar, and the Kodesh HaKadoshim and the Aaron? One other connection which we know, the only time well, one of the only times, that the Kohen Gadol would ever enter into the innermost sanctum would be on one day a year, and that would be Yom Kippur. How would he enter into the Eder Kodesh HaKadoshim? Using what? What was the actual sacrifice brought there? Was incense. Which means that he took off incense, the coals were from the outer Mizbeach, but the incense was usually the incense which would be brought. It was its own specific formula for this day. But it would be the incense which would be brought into the base Kodesh HaKadoshim, which means to say there's an intrinsic connection between the Ketores and the Aaron and the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So these two implements being parallel to one another geographically and also in thought and in service is something worth noting. There is an interesting point over here, and that is, technically speaking, it could really be the same Mizbeach as the one that was used in the Mishkan, but it's not. How do we know this is not the same Mizbeach? They didn't just, you know, like, okay, the temple's being renewed. Why can't we use the old Mizbeach? How do we know it's not the same one? One of the reasons we know is because... Oh, so it does not give the dimensions, so we still have flexibility in terms of dimensions, because it was a very small Mizbeach, much smaller than the outside Mizbeach. One of the reasons is, what is it made of? What is it described being made of in this context? It says, it was made over here of, it was made of erez, it was made of cedar wood. What was the one in the Mishkan made of? Shittim, acacia wood. So it's made of a different wood. Which is interesting, so it has to be a different altar. And Rashi says, I don't know why. Rashi says, I'm not sure why they had to replace it, because everything else you had to replace, but not with the Mizbeach HaZahav, could have been the same. Rashi actually says this in Source 33. It's interesting. Rashi just admits, he says, Vayitzav HaMizbeach Erez, Hu Mizbeach HaKetores, V'tomeya Ani, V'shel Moshe Lama Nignaz. Why did they take away Moshe's Mizbeach, which theoretically could play the same role in this Mizbeach? I don't know, but it clearly is a different one because it's made of a different type of wood. Just a thought worth noting over here. Let's dive a little further. To me, the most interesting part of this perek is this next section, and that is the angels. Because here is one of the biggest shifts in what we're used to thinking and what we're actually going to see now. Here's how it works. So the Kruvim take us from Psukim Chof Gimel to Chof Ches. 23 to 28 is our next journey. I'm going to really start at the right pasuk this time. It's on the top of page 5 in the notes. Vayas bidvir shnei kruvim atzei shomen. He made two cherubs out of what's literally, if you were to translate it literally, it would be oil wood, which you may say is, who said that? Olive wood, right, which is the way they translated it. Eser amos kamosoi, there were 10 amos in 10 cubits high. V'chomesh amos knaf ha-kruva echas, v'chomesh amos knaf ha-kruva shenis, and each wing had a wingspan of 5 amos long. Eser amos miktsois ha-knafav, ha-ksois knafav. And had, therefore, the sum total wingspan was 10. Right, so to make it very clear to us, the Eser ba'amah kruv hasheni, and the other kruv, the other cherub, was also 10 amos high. Midachas or kotzev echad lishnei kruvim. They were formed of one measure, they had one mold, so to speak. Kolmas akruv echad Eser ba'amah v'chein hu akruv hasheni. Each one is 10 tall. And then vayiten es akruvim b'soichat ba'is apenimi, and he placed them in the inner chamber. Vayifrusu es kanfei akruvim v'tigak knaf echad bakir uknaf akruv hasheni nogas bakir hasheni. And the wingtips would be touching either wall, and then they'll be touching each other. The tips of the wings on the inside would touch each other. Why? How wide is the house again? How wide is the devir? 20 amos. How wide is the wingspan of each crew of 10? So it makes sense. It's just fit. They kind of just touching the tips of either wall, and they're the innermost tip above the aron. And he covered them with gold. That's the section. Fascinating. So we think, when we think about the Kruvim, we think about the cherubs which are on top of the Aaron, on top of the Aaron itself. Now, this is not to negate them. The Aaron was still there. That means to say, how many Kruvim were there in the base of Mikdash? There were 4 Kruvim. There were the ones on top of the altar themselves, and there were the ones that were standing on top of the Aaron, on top of the Ark, and there were the two that stood next to the Ark. The huge ones and the small ones. Fascinating. People aren't aware of the fact that this looked very different to the Mishkan pictures that we're seeing. What was that?
What about the
it's a good question. So we're going to get to the parochas in a second. There's not a parochas in this. There is a curtain, but it's not. It doesn't work the same way. In the Mishkan, it was one simple curtain. We're going to get there. We haven't got to that part of the room yet. But now let's try to dig a little deeper. What is going on over here? So first of all, what wood are they made of? It says atzei shemen. It means oil wood. So the most likely candidate we would think about would be olive woods. Now, olive trees are not huge, so it's, you know, generally not used for this for furniture making. But it is interesting that we've changed now from cedar and cypress wood to oil wood. The Barbanel actually argues that this is not olive wood, or olive wood. It is in fact still cedar wood, but it's the cedar wood that comes from the part of the tree which generates the fruit, which is, means to say it's more fragrant. Isn't that interesting? So he says it's actually got more, it itself is more flush with sap. It is more oily and therefore more fragrant, and they use the best of the best wood for the kerubim themselves. That's what the Abarbanel argues. I'm not going to read that inside, but it's interesting to note. So his way of looking at this. The Abarbanel has a very fascinating perspective on this perek, which now leads us to an interesting point. What were the big kerubim made of? What substance? Wood. What were the small kruvim made of? Gold. That's just an interesting point to notice. They all look gold because they're all covered with gold. But one is gold to the core on top of the aron, and the ones on the side are wood covered with gold. We have a different perspective here. What's going on over here? Two fascinating perspectives on this. One, the Gemara points out, which is just an interesting thing which we may have missed. I would have missed this point when reading through, but the Gemara makes an interesting note on this. The Gemara in Baba Basra tells us in Source 37, Omar Ravanai, Omar Shmuel, Kruvim Benes Hein Omdin. They stood miraculously. What does it mean they stood miraculously? V'chamesh amos haya knafa kruva yachas, v'chamesh amos knafa kruva shenis. If each of the wings was 5 amos long, then amos mukusa ois, miksoisa knafov, aksosa knafov, gufayu hecha havu kaimi. Look, if you have a bird, now this is not a bird, but if you have a creature that has wings coming out each side of its body, and the wing on the one side is 5, and the wing on the other side is 5, but you have a body in between, that means to say it must be wider than 10 in total, right? Just basic math. Unless the wings are coming out somewhere over its back or over out of its head, there has to be space for the body in the middle. The assumption of the Gemara is the wings are coming out the side like they would of a bird. That being the case, the Gemara argues that there is a spatial problem over here, and that is that the bodies do not take up space, which actually reminds us of another concept where there's no space taken up, because the Gemara also tells us that the Aron Eina Min Hamida, which means that if you were to measure the amount of space on each side of the Aron in the Dvir, you would take a tape measure out, and you'd measure 10 amos on one side, and you'd measure on the other side, you'd find there'd be 10 amos. But wait a second, how wide was the room? 20 in total. So you can't measure 10 on one side and 10 on the other, because the middle must take up space. So the Gemara concludes from here that Aron Eina Min Hamida, which means that the Aron, the Ark, was not subject to the regular confines or the regular regulations of space. The reason why this works, just understand that how this is what's called a wormhole. A wormhole is where you have an interface between two different dimensions. This is the place in the universe where you have the interface between the physical and the spiritual. In a certain sense, what the Kabbalists say, this is the makor, this is the source of all space. Space was generated out of this wormhole. Well, what happens is you have irregularities at wormholes. You see that in the wormhole itself, it shares rules of both sides of it, of that tunnel, which means you start seeing where space starts collapsing, which is why in the space of the spiritual and metaphysical, the physical starts breaking down and space no longer acts. By the way, we'll get to it later, but we'll see that time breaks down in the earlier chamber. Right? It's interesting. Time, which is the other constraint of existence, doesn't exist in the Heichal, the Kodesh. Where do we see that?
No.
The menorah and the bread. The bread never got stale and the menorah never went out, which means it wasn't under the confines of time. As you went into the innermost sanctum, space breaks down, which means to say that now you, when you start measuring things, it looks like you're seeing something physical, but it doesn't actually take up the space that it looks like it's taking up anymore. So this is when you start seeing where things start melting away. The regular logic of this world doesn't operate in the same way. That's what the Gemara is pointing out. Fascinating. Let's take it one step further. Which way were these kruvim facing? How would you expect them to be facing? Let's go back to the ones that belonged on the Aron itself. Where were they facing? They faced each other. So they had good times, right? They faced each other. Where were these facing? Says the Abarbanel, and says that based on the Gemara, that they were actually pivoted, looking in a certain sense towards the entrance door. You can imagine this. When the Kohen would walk in, the immense kruvim, these huge kruvim, would be looking at him, so to speak, as he walked in. So they weren't facing each other. That's fascinating. Why? Why the shift between the mini Kruvim and the macro Kruvim? What was going on over here? So there's a very interesting insight, which is expressed and developed by a person by the name of Rav Chaim Volozhiner, who has a sefer called Nefesh HaChaim. It's a Kabbalistic work, and very, very deep ideas and underpinnings of Judaism. And he says a very beautiful thing. He says, because they were created at two different stages in Jewish history. If you think about this for a second. When were the first set of angels on the Aron created? Which stage in Jewish history? This is after Cheder Egel, the Dor HaMidbar. Right, we have this generation here. Essentially, for the next 39 years, they are going to have full laundry services, full food services, everything they possibly need is taken care of. In fact, so much so that the Gemara tells us that when people would eat from the manna, from the man, they wouldn't even need to go to the restroom. That's how it was perfectly attuned to the human body, that there was no, all we'll call it regular functions of our busy lives, whether it be work, sustenance, food, all taken care of. They could spend the entire time contemplating on God and learning Torah and being involved in the spiritual, which meant if the two Kruvim are meant to represent, in a certain sense, the relationship between God and human, how were they facing? They were facing each other, because there's no interruptions. It was a full, complete, covenantal relationship in which there was no distractions. However, the second Kruvim are created by Shlomo HaMelech. At this point in time, most of the people are farmers, soldiers, shepherds, you name it, blacksmiths, fishmongers, every profession necessary to be able to govern a society. When this happens now, the Kruvim, so to speak, the two players, human and the divine, are no longer facing each other fully. They're not facing each other. Why not? Because life is busy. Humans don't have the time to be facing God all day long. Now all the things which they had in the desert are no longer here. They have to now be involved in regular life. So they're pivoted. It doesn't mean to say that they're facing the wall fully. The Gemara says they're at an angle, at a 45-degree angle, so to speak, facing themselves a little bit and facing the door a little bit, which means the wall. So there's an element now of, in a certain sense, the pivot of society, right? Society is no longer able to fully focus on God, but in a more realistic sense, they're also working on their lives and trying to bring God back into that life. Is that a fascinating way of looking at this? I think it also relates to the material. Which is a more pure material? The gold. The first Kruvim, pure gold. Here it's on your cover of gold, but it's actually more real. It's the wood. It's the wood of life. It's the wood of society, which you're seeing over here. Just a fascinating thing. One last question. I want to leave this just for homework, because it's such an interesting thing. If it's true that the two representatives, the metaphor over here is one angel and another angel is God and Israel, then who's the one who's more distracted now? Israel, right? They're the ones who are too busy. Now, so what should happen? You should have one angel looking intently at the other one, and the other angel is pivoted ever so slightly away because it's more now involved in the busyness of this world. Why were both angels pivoted, metaphorically? Why is God also looking towards the wall a little bit in a 45-degree angle? Just a question for him. There's an answer to this. I want to leave that out there as a very fascinating... This is exactly the point that the Nefesh HaChaim, Rav Chaim Volozhiner, is developing over here. But the idea of the four Kruvim, of these angels. I did put in a picture over here, just to give a let's see if it's over here. Where is this? They're on the top of page 16. So they're sort of an image of it again. We don't really know what angels look like, but just to give you a sense of the magnificence of their wings are soichachim, which means they're covering over the Aron, and there's the smaller angels in the middle there. It's a very, very beautiful picture as a description. Let's go into the next step. Let's try to get a little more over here to complete this section. We are told the next step, which is the following. This is after the angels. We are now moving into the internal curtain. So relating to Ira's point just a moment ago. Chav tes to lamed beis. This next section. So we're told back in the Pesukim, Ushtei dal sois atzei shemen, there were two olive wood or oil wood doors, the kola alehem mikloois kruvim v'simrois puturei tzitzim v'tzipor zahav, and carved on them were cherubs, palm trees, and open flowers. V'yored al akruvim al timrois es azahav, and they spread gold over these engravings. These are on the doors into the inner sanctum. And they made a the doors to the temple itself, because the doors we're just talking about are the doors to the Dvir, the innermost sanctum. Now the doors, the outer, the doors to the Heichal itself were also made of this oil wood, and they were in a four square, framed in a four square. Ushtei dal sois atzev rosim, and two doors of cypress wood. Ushnei tzlaim hadelas achas kelilim, ushnei klaim hadelas hashenis kelilim, and they were, the leaves of the doors were folded into each other. This is the outermost doors. V'kala kruvim v'simrois u'puturei tzitzim v'tzipa zahav miyushar al hamechukeh. And it was overlaid with the gold fitted into the graven work again. So this is another description of this as well. One second. Okay, let's hold here for a second. So there's just a few things to think about over here is that we're seeing that it's not the typical paroiches before, and the divisions between in the makeshift Mishkan, which was this traveling sanctuary, it was a curtain between the innermost sanctum and the outermost sanctum, and another curtain called the Masach HaPesach, which was dividing it from the courtyard. Here we actually have doors, and the way it's described, as the Barbanel describes it, is that actually every entrance had four doors, two inwards, two outwards, right? So if you can imagine this, and which were in this framework over here, and all of them are carved with angels. Now, Barbanel also makes a very fascinating point over here, is that when you carve something out, which way is the shape? The shape is? It's into the actual wood itself. So it's impressed upon the structure. So he makes an interesting point. He says that when you're in the sanctuary, when you're in the actual Kodesh HaKadoshim, the angels are three-dimensional. They're extruding, protruding. When you are outside of the sanctuary, they are engraved into the wood itself. Just an interesting shift in the way that the angels are over here, the way the angels are engraved. Let's take a one step further over here. Let's try to push a little bit further. Ooh, did I skip something here? No, I think we are here. No, I think we're set over here. The one thing I did leave out is I did leave out one pasuk which I think was important. I think we left out the section of Chof Tes to Lamed Beis. I apologize. That's the section we left out. There's one important point which I don't want to leave out here, which says Veis Kol Kiros Abayis Mosach Meisav Kola Pituchei Mikloos Kruvim Simros Pituret Tzitzim. No, we did this. We did do this. The pasuk that I wanted to focus on, which I think we left out, was pasuk Lamed Aleph. It talks about at the end Ha'ayil Mezuzois Hachamishis. There was a doorpost of the fifth frame. That's an interesting description. The doorpost of the fifth frame. When it describes the doors, apparently there's the fifth frame. Now, generally speaking, that's a little bit hard to imagine because door frames either have four sides or maybe three sides. You know, it's very hard to imagine five sides. So what's this description of the fifth frame? So there's a few interesting suggestions. Take a look in source 40. Rashi has a very interesting suggestion. He says, Mezuzos HaChamishis, HaMiftan Echad, that means to say, what's the Miftan? In Hebrew, the Miftan is the bottom lintel, like, you know, what you put your foot on when you walk through the door frame. That's one. HaMezuzos Mikan Mikan Shtayim, the mezuzah means the frame on either side is two, so that's one on the bottom, two on the right and the left. HaRei Shalosh, he says, VaMashkoif She'alav Asui Kishtayim, Kozeh Kach Shamati. And then the one at the top was from here and from here. And he says, Kazeh, which means that in the Rashi you should find the actual picture. And this is the suggestion on the right-hand side. You see this picture? Mm-hmm. Where the top lintel of the door was a triangle. Right? So you have five, you have essentially five parts. It was a pentagon shape, essentially, to the entrance of the door. So there was a unique door frame. It's not as much of a practical door frame as it is a decorative door frame, what Rashi is getting to us. Rashi has another suggestion. Why should it be a five frame? He says another one. He says, "Ani Omer mezuzos hachamishis chamishot zelaois hayul mezuzos veloios amerubas." Every part of the frame was actually a pentagonal shape, as opposed to a square shape, which means that every post, every doorpost, had five sides. Not that the actual aperture had five sides, but the doorpost. Now again, this is not a practical measure. This is a decorative measure. This is something which goes the extra mile to show you this. Just a fascinating insight. There is a third suggestion over here. What's this fifth gate or fifth part of the door. We're not going to read it inside, but the Rabbag says that you actually count the doors to get into the Azora, the courtyard, and the Ezras Kohanim, and the Ulam, and the Heichal, and the Dvir. There are five different boundaries. This is referring to the fifth of those doors coming in from the outside. There are five sets of gates necessary to be able to get into the innermost chamber. That's the way he understands this. So just getting a sense of the picture. Finally, just to close this section, because you can see there's a lot of sort of structural pictures over here. We're going to focus on the last section, which is we're going to do Psukim Lamed Vav, which is its own one pasuk section. Vayiven es echotzer hapnimis shloisha turei gaziz v'tur kerusois arozim. He built the inner court with three rows of hewn stone and a row of cedar beams. What is this inner court? It does not sound like this is inside the building necessarily, right? So it is outside of the building. Up to now, everything we're doing has been inside the building. So it sounds like over here, this is what the Meforshim says, what's called the Ezras Kohanim. And there's a beautiful relief, which is on page 17, where you can sort of see the trajectory, the general, if you do a sliced view of the Beis HaMikdash over here, you could see the different levels. And as you proceed towards the Holier, you keep moving up the stairs. So on the rightmost side, you have the Harabais, the Soreg and the Chayil. That's where on the bottom right side is the actual level of Harabais, where that's the Temple Mount. You go up a number of stairs into what's called the Ezras Noshim, the women's section. By the way, the women's section was the most publicly used section. So for instance, on the Simchas Beis HaShoeva, that's where everybody was. This was the most publicly used station. Then they'll go up those next steps. The next steps over here, I believe, would be where we have the Shir HaMa'alos, where you have the 15 steps with lions and eagles going up into the next section, is into the Ezras Yisrael, which is a very small section, leading up a few more steps into the Ezras Kohanim, where the Mizbeach would be, and then you get into the actual building itself. This section called the Ezras Kohanim, the area of the priests, which is where they would do their sacrifice, where they would bring the korbanos, and they would slaughter and burn, and where the Mizbeach belonged, that's the section over here. And the description is being told to us that it was made of these cut stones as the floor with the hewn cedars as well. That's the description. Very little details given to this area, even though it's a very large area. And finally, we're told, now in terms of structure, the last two psukim, this entire perek, which I apologize for rushing to get to, say the following. Bashanah ha-revi'is, on the fourth year, Yusad Beis Hashem b'yerech ziv, the house found its foundation in the month of Ziv, bul, and in the 11th year, in the month of Bul, Shashmini, the 8th month, sheva shanim. It took 7 years of work to make the Beis HaMikdash, and it went from the month of Ziv to Bul. Now, folks, we don't talk those languages, right? What months are these? Ziv is the month of Iyar, as we call it today in the Babylonian. Iyar is a Babylonian name. And Bul is the month of Mar Cheshon, what we call it today. Which means it wasn't just 7 years, the Ralbo points out. It was actually really 7.5 years that it took to get there. So the month after Pesach to the month after Sukkot. So we have to see how that squares with our timeline. Which leads us to a very fascinating seasonal comment, certainly in the Northern Hemisphere. And this is what the Meir Shiloach points out at the very end of the last comment here in our sources, but I'm going to just say it outside for the sake of brevity. And he says, generally speaking, in the Northern Hemisphere, what's happening in Iyar time? What's happening outside? Iyar is where we're starting to see the blossoms are coming in. You know, it's around Pesach time, the blossoms are a little late, the light green leaves are coming out, we're starting to see everything in bloom, the highways are starting to look like they're covered again with trees again. It's a beautiful time of growth. What's happening in Mar Cheshvan time? We just passed Mar Cheshvan. That's when everything's starting to die, right? That's when the trees are losing their leaves, all the deciduous trees are shedding. We know the weather's taking a turn for the cold. The animals are starting to collect to hibernate. So in a certain sense, we think as the upturn of events is in the spring and the downturn of events is in the fall. So the Meir Shiloach says, because this building was not simply a physical building, it actually followed the opposite logic, which is that yes, the beginning was in the spring, but the real beginning of when it started to be used was actually in the fall. Which means just when you think that was the end of the season is actually when the spiritual is actually now taking seed, which is something worthwhile thinking, because sometimes the most amount of work we get done in the year is in the winter. Our most productive months are these months in the sun. In fact, most of the Jewish holidays, ironically, there's the summer holidays, but the Derabbanan holidays are in this section over here, where a lot of the work we get done is through this period of time. And the Beis HaMikdash was founded at the time when there was a downturn in the physical to remind us that there's an upturn in the spiritual. So this is a lot of information that we covered in an extremely short amount of time. But let's just do a quick recap. We looked at the Devir, the innermost sanctum. We looked at the Heichal. We looked at the paneling of the walls, the paneling of the floors. We looked at also the Kruvim, the very unusual Kruvim. We looked at the door frames. Last time we looked at the windows as well. And how the doors from each of the five entrances would operate. And finally, the seven and a half year process to getting to the Beis HaMikdash. What this leaves us for us next time in 2 weeks' time is, God willing, unpacking the Kalim and seeing how all the different Kalim operate in the Beis HaMikdash. I hope this is an elevating experience. Thank you for taking the time.